Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
Okay, so to start off this podcast, I have a challenge for everyone. I want you to go quick to your pantry or your fridge if you're at your house and grab a food that has an ingredient label on the back and start reading off those ingredients. Do you recognize more than 8 out of 10 of those first words on the label? No? Do you recognize more than 3 of them or 2 of them? If you don't recognize the majority of the words, you're likely dealing with a food that is ultra processed, has so many preservatives, additives, and everything added into it to make it highly palatable, and it is likely less nutrient dense. How about these ingredients? We got kale, broccoli, pumpkin seeds, blueberries, spirulina, cherry, turmeric, ginger. On the other hand, we're looking at 100% grass-fed beef, unprocessed sea salt, celery juice, black pepper, red pepper, garlic powder, coriander. Everything organic, everything of the highest quality. These are the ingredients in our Paleo Valley snacks. They're two snacks that are always in our cupboard. And as you can see, the ingredients on there are things you can trust. They're things you recognize. And they're things that you know are bringing a superfood punch of antioxidant power, anti-inflammatory power. The reason that it's so important that the beef and all their products is 100% grass-fed has to do with that omega-3 ratio, the omega-3 to the omega-6. We want a much higher ratio of omega-3s, and animal products that are raised with a 100% grass-fed diet have much higher ratios of omega-3s. Why am I saying all this? Because it's so hard to find snacks that you can trust, that you can take out the door quick and eat. Jen and I use Paleo Valley. We trust Paleo Valley. They have amazing beef sticks, turkey sticks. They also have bone broth protein bars that I love. They have a new flavor, lemon meringue, so go check them out. Code OPTIMAL gets you 15% off your order. You will not be disappointed. Try them out. Let us know which ones are your favorite. Here's the episode.
Up on the podcast next, we get to interview our beautiful friend, Dr. Liz Letchford, who's an athletic trainer and a strength coach who takes holistic approaches to improving mechanics, posture, and pain. But also, she went back and she actually got her PhD in kinesiology and rehab science. And her interests are really focused on improving injury risk reduction and the relationship between biomechanics and human emotion. Emotion, that's what we're going to really dive into. How does that play a role in biomechanics? How does that play a role in pain, in how you move, in how you feel? So I'm so excited about this interview. She's the creator of something called The Release, a self-massage and movement experience designed to help students get out of their head and into their body. And Dom and I have both participated in her class. It is, I will say, absolutely amazing. And Liz is also a founding coach for Tonal. Maybe you've seen that around, which is a connected fitness company where she is a part of the research and innovation team, and she's also a coach. With a deep passion for using movement to improve quality of life, Liz really plays an integral role in understanding and influencing change in the intersection of fitness and rehab. I know you're going to enjoy this episode. Be sure to pass it along to anyone you know it could support as well. Let's dive right in. So excited to have you on the podcast, Liz. You are just such a breath of fresh air, first of all. Like, your energy every time I'm around you is magical. And you're also super smart. So, bonus.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you on just because kind of your path and how you've gone through this, you know, going into the field of athletic training and then wanting to get more into research, getting your PhD, which congrats, by the way, that's not too long ago still. And I know that that's a haul to do that. First, I just kind of want to get an idea of what drew you into this field of helping people and being able to help people through working with them on their bodies.
Oh, I've always been drawn to it. When I was a kid, I would watch like ER TV shows when I was at home, like trauma. Remember that trauma life in the ER? Like, not your typical like 11-year-old TV show of choice, but I was so into it. My first job was a lifeguard. My second job was an EMT. Mm. I went into athletic training because I wanted to really make a difference and understand from So athletic training is a little bit different than physical therapy in that we're on the field responding to the actual injury when it happens. And so I love the idea of taking an athlete or taking somebody through from the moment it happens all the way to return to play. It's in my bones. It's in my blood. You know, maybe it's just I'm a firstborn and it's it's whatever happened when I was growing up made me like really care about taking care of people, but it's just in me. And so after exploring some of the shadow side of that, of like giving without pouring into myself, I feel like I'm in this really great, healthy space to take care of other people and gain knowledge as much as I can and really change the face of care and of fitness and of rehabilitation.
You're definitely doing that. So kudos to you. I love just to see your journey. And I want you to kind of go back a little bit, just the difference between ATC and PT. I think that's still a little bit lost on people because you do, like you said, you're there in right away when something happens. So usually athletic trainers are then going to work with a team, right? And not so much in a clinic, or do you still get to work in the clinic? Like, what is the difference then between someone going to see an ATC and someone going to see a PT?
Well, it's ever changing. Traditionally, ATCs worked in a team environment. So there was one or two athletic trainers with, like, you know, when a football player gets injured, that's the team that runs out on the field. It's usually an athletic trainer and a team physician. And that's what it was traditionally, but they found that the skills of an athletic trainer could be really useful in an industrial environment, looking at industrial athletes or in firefighters and policemen, tactical athletes, Army, Navy, all the military. And just recently, there has been this cool emergence of independent athletic trainers where I work as a kind of as a personal trainer, but I have the knowledge and skill set of an athletic trainer. So I work one-on-one with people who are recovering from injuries, dealing with intense illnesses or chronic pain, and who have graduated essentially from physical therapy and who have fitness goals. And so I love working in conjunction with physical therapists. You have a much deeper breadth of knowledge of the like intense rehab, post-surgical specifications. You can do joint mobilizations. You have a couple more skills than athletic trainers do. And so it's cool to have the team. I know that there's this funny culture war really between athletic trainers and physical therapists, but it's such a cool team. I worked for 6 years in a team environment working with a physical therapist as an athletic trainer. And I love that I was respected by the physical therapist and that I respected the physical therapist and their knowledge and skill set. And so, yeah, I'm just here to say we can exist in the same place and we have really cool skill sets that are so complementary.
I really appreciate how you just kind of went through that, and you bring up like the turf war, and it started bothering me as soon as I started hearing that coming into PT school, because like you're saying, I learned so much from different ATCs when I was an athlete myself. And I'm like, yes, I know that they have knowledge and that they can help me continue to learn, and you have your own area of expertise. And even within the world of ATCs and PTs and personal trainers, there's so much different training you do after that, and you can do after that to specify a little bit more as an ATC in a certain area versus a, you know, personal trainer. And I really, really like, you know, how you brought up, I think it's cool the opportunities that are emerging for fields like athletic training, where you can have a little bit more of that independence in helping people, you know, frontline, where our medical system is getting so inundated with at the primary level, but we have all of these amazing professionals that are continuing to advance their profession who can really help relieve some of this pressure that is being put on our medical system right now.
Totally, totally.
Now, what took you down the route of you're already helping people? Let me continue to learn more. Let me go get my PhD. Like, what was that pull for you and that desire to continue down that path?
In truth, I was looking for jobs and I just didn't feel called to working with any particular team that I found. I just felt like, I don't think this is it. I really enjoyed teaching. As part of my master's program, I had the pleasure of teaching a few, like as a grad assistant, teaching a few courses, exercise physiology, some of the basic, 300 level courses. And I really fell in love with it. I got to kind of have a stage to influence and impact the future healthcare leaders and change what I saw to be the pain points of the healthcare industry. I mean, that's the reason I got into it. I'm like, I want to change this. I want to really bring care and emotion and freedom and see the human behind the body. And so I just felt a big call to continue pursuing a route that would allow me to teach at a greater capacity than just working with the sports team, being hands-on in the clinic. So I applied to and got into the University of Hawaii. I figured if I'm gonna work my butt off, I might as well be in paradise.
So, I love it.
And so the University of Hawaii had a really cool athletic trainer cohort that, so all of my colleagues were in my cohort were athletic trainers. So we had this shared dialogue, which in a lot of PhD programs, that's not the case. So that's why I was drawn to that particular program. They had a big emphasis on biomechanics and then a big emphasis on anatomy and physiology. So I got to be really imbued in cadaver anatomy and biomechanics. We had a whole motion capture lab and I got to ask questions. We did a lot of work with hips and knees and athletes, and there's a big military population out there too. Mm. So we did a lot of work with the military, with the aging population. Mm. And I just felt the entire time, I noticed as you learn more, you're less regurgitating information. And I noticed when I was a baby athletic trainer, and I'm sure you can relate, when you were a baby PT, you kind of regurgitate what you learned in school. And it's the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Like the less you know, the more you think you're an expert. Yeah. And I was totally there. I was totally guilty of that. And so as I worked through my master's program, as I learned more, as I worked with athletes, I mean, I had worked with a number of teams, I realized I didn't know anything, and I was surprised and shocked every single time that I saw something appear in the clinic that was totally opposite of what I've learned in the books. And that just kept happening and kept happening until I was like, mm-hmm. Okay, I've got to stay curious. I've got to stay really curious and treat each individual as an individual. And in that way, I learned how oftentimes these blanket treatment protocols that we give people are actually not appropriate for some individuals. Maybe in general, maybe if we're taking the average of every person, maybe it would be effective. But on the individual level, these treatments might not necessarily be true, even with the same symptom presentation. And so that got me thinking, in addition to my experience I was a volunteer EMT for a couple of years. So I got to really see people and hold space for people's worst day of their life. Every time I met someone, it was the worst day of their life. So I observed in that scenario too. So not only in the rehabilitation scenario, but in the emergency medicine scenario, the blatant lack of looking at the person and speaking to the person. And I don't know if that was just my gift or something that I don't know why I placed such an emphasis on the person behind the medical condition, but I just did. Through that lens, I noticed there's so much wrong, and we're not treating the whole person if we're just treating the medical condition that this person happens to be dealing with at that time.
Mm. I think that's so powerful, and I love how there's so many things there's so many like different alleyways that I want to dive down with you right now because of all the different things you're bringing up about coming from this athletic training realm, going into this PhD program that was very, like you said, biomechanically and anatomy and physiology driven, which in my experience doesn't include a lot of the things you're talking about in focusing on the person within their whole body and focusing on their emotions. And so I'm wondering what, through this process of getting your PhD, what impact that had on how you worked with clients, or if you had any major takeaways, I know you've already talked about a few, that you brought into your practice with working with clients?
It was difficult. I've always been kind of a black sheep, if you couldn't tell already. I'm like this like real feelsy clinician, and I'm like a real sciencey feeler. So in any place that I put myself, I kind of own the middle in so many aspects of my life. And so to be able to see things from a number of different perspectives, to see things from the Western perspective, as well as a more spiritual perspective, to see things from a medical perspective, as well as the emotional, the psychosocial component of a patient, is a gift and something that I want to share with people. But my PhD program, being highly, highly, highly biomechanical, the people that I work with, my professors, were very much on one side, meaning this is the science, these are the numbers, this is what it is, this is the average that we found, this is the conclusion we can draw. And my brain works, and I respect that. And I love talking to people who have zero part in them that's like, oh, flowery, emotional, you know, like that side of the brain. Because it challenges me and allows me an opportunity to refine my perspective, really own that middle ground to be able to see both sides. But being in a program that was highly scientific, highly rigorous, highly biomechanically driven, I was able to ask questions that couldn't necessarily be answered with the research. And that was important for everyone, including my professors, to see. My particular study, I looked at high school and collegiate athletes. I tested something called a landing error scoring system. So there's a huge ACL injury epidemic in female athletes. And I wanted to contribute and figure out, can we create a testing protocol, or what are the testing protocols we're using to find before they even get the injury? How can we evaluate whether or not they are susceptible to that injury? So I took a look, I picked apart this test that we use to determine whether an athlete is susceptible to ACL injury. And I proposed at the end of my study, I proposed a refined assessment. That's all cool, right? Cool is great. Cool study. But what the juice, cool study, bro. The juice that I got, the juicy part of that for me as a human being, as a researcher, was all the questions that I asked in my intake survey that I didn't necessarily include as part of the study, but I'm so excited to include later. So I would ask these girls, I saw, because I have this gift of seeing the human behind the subject, I knew, okay, you're coming in, you're going to do a jump test for me, I'm going to measure your joints and bones and angles and forces, and then we're going to spit out a couple of numbers. But what this big $40,000 equipment system doesn't tell me is, how are you doing? What are your stress levels? What's going on in your life, baby girl? You know, like how are you really? Because we all know, we've all tried to work out when we're stressed and our bodies move differently. We've all felt sad or sick or overwhelmed and felt a change in the way that we move, the way that we present, the way that we show up in the world. And so I asked all of those questions. I asked, you know, how stressed are you on a Likert scale, a scale of like, you know, 1 to 10? How intense has this school year been? They're all high school overachieving athletes. What's it been like in your home life? Are you dealing with any significant life events? So none of those actually made their way into my study, just because that's not what my main hypothesis, that's not the question that I was asking. But I knew, okay, in the future, I'm going to take a look at this stress that these young women are experiencing and how it affects the way that they move. So I'm so excited to now go forth. And this is something I'm very passionate about, is the effect of your emotional state and how that affects your body, how that affects your somatic system, so your body system. And can we actually improve performance by addressing those things? Can I help an athlete improve their performance and decrease their risk for injury by allowing them space to express and to understand their emotions, whether they are good or bad?
My goodness. Like, seriously, as you're talking, I was getting so many chills as you're going through this, because this this is it. Like, truly, when I stepped away from clinic and being kind of like having to do person after person after person, not having even the space to be able to really talk to them because you have all these other people around you. When I got to work one-on-one for an hour at least with someone and really get to see, how are you? Like, what how is really you? Happening? You know, right. it really does change the treatment pattern and the response and what happens so much. And so this is everything. I love where you're heading. And I love that we're going to have, you know, research articles from you to be able to prove this stuff eventually.
Yes.
But just, you know, with your understanding of working with people, what are you seeing right now in terms of maybe it's your hypothesis of things? Yes, we don't have concrete studies, but what can you say based on if someone is in a very stressed place? How does that change their body response? What does that do to the body?
Let me tell you a story of a client that I'm working with right now. So in addition to doing research, I still see clients. I think that's very important. It keeps me grounded. It's also my favorite thing to do. So right now I'm working with somebody who has trouble staying in their body. So she experiences something called dissociation, where it's as if she's floating above her body. And that's due to a number of traumas that happened when she was very, very young. And then the type of trauma is not important. Just know that there was a trauma that had her feel like she couldn't trust her own body. So she had worked with a number of people. Interestingly enough, she wants to be very strong. She really wants to live strong in her body. And so she had started and subsequently stopped a number of training programs right at the 13-week mark. So she had started a Pilates program with a trainer. She had started a fitness boot camp. You name it, she's tried it, but she always gives up around 13 weeks. That number is going to be important in a moment. So she came to me and I told her, hey, we're going to address, I come from a biomechanical perspective, so we're going to address what's really going on physically in your body, mechanically in your body. I'm going to help you, you know, she had a couple of pain points. We're going to help tune those up. Mm-hmm. And if we find that the exercises that we do aren't quite addressing it, then we're going to dive deeper into what's going on emotionally. And so our first session, it was very clear. I had her be honest with me. I said, if anything comes up, you won't hurt my feelings. I want you to just let me know what you're thinking. And so as we were going through, I was taking her through some very basic core stability exercises to both assess and then strengthen her ability to maintain a stable core as she moved her shoulders and moved her hips. So we did things like bird dogs, which is lying on the floor, or dead bugs lying on the floor, right? And so she had a lot of difficulty in those movements. Like, we really had to bring things down to basics in order to find true, proper core stability. So then after that, I had her do some seated lat pulldowns. And while she was doing the seated lat pulldown, she said, I'm feeling some anger come up. And I said, okay, all right, I'm celebrating that. That's a thank you for letting me know. Let's hold space for that. And so as she continued to do that, I felt intuitively like, you know what? Let's give this anger a runway. Let's just give it a stage and see what wants to come out. So I got her consent. I let her know, hey, I'd love to try something with you. And she was so totally down. And so what I did was I took her away from the lat pull downs and I said, we're going to play one song. And I put on some like death metal music. We're going to play one song. And I want you to give that anger a voice. And so we played, I played it really loud. I gave her a pillow to scream into. I said, what does that anger sound like? And she screamed into the pillow and she cried and she banged her hand on the floor. And then I gave her a sexy song. I said, now, if I just left you here after expressing that anger, you'd feel really raw. So let's transmute that with your own sexiness. Okay. I want you to feel and embody what it's like to feel completely proud and proud of your body and strong. And so then I put on like some, you know, Magic Mike fun little song and she was just giggling all the way through. So that was a tool that I used to not only transmute and leave her not raw and open, but have her feel like, wow, my anger has a place and my anger is not something that I need to hide. So after that, that was a lot. So after that, I just took her through a meditation. The real beauty came from her when we integrated that experience, when we allowed her to understand intellectually what was going on. She said, you know, I went back to, while I was expressing my anger, I went back to that trauma, that time where that trauma was first introduced to me. And I realized for the first time in my life that strength, in order to be strong, it was also terrifying. I felt like I was a silent scream. I had to retract and protect myself from this inciting incident. And so physiologically, we know, remember that 13-week thing? So physiologically, we know at about 12 weeks, the body truly improves strength. Physiologically, it takes about 12 weeks. So at about week 13, her body recognized herself getting stronger and part of her body was like, being strong means being terrified and I'm over this. So unconsciously, she was like, I'm done. I can't, this is it. And so once we made that connection, she was like, holy cow. So now that she's brought awareness to the fact that strong means a shield, I said, let's work on strong being the warrior behind the shield. Mm. And so she came back to me the next session. You better believe her body worked completely differently. She was doing, I was continuously progressing her from bird dogs to single, like resisted bird dogs, bird dog with a rope. She was doing dead bugs with her hands against the wall. It was like, huh? Her body knew how to stabilize instantly because I finally gave her the space to express her anger and to make the connection of, oh, strength doesn't necessarily have to mean the shield. So I share that story because that's one person. And if she would have gone to anyone else who might not have been conscious or created a safe space for her to express exactly how she was feeling, let alone scream into a pillow and then feel sexy after. You know, that she would have just been doing bird dogs for 12 weeks, never gotten better, and then, you know, given up on feeling strong in general. So this was in one session. So I know I've seen it time and time again, and I have countless stories of people who I've created a safe place for them to express.
Jen and I are like looking at each other battling over who's going to say something next, because we both, I think that this story that you're talking about right now is not characteristic of the general practitioner coming out of an ATC school or a PT school. And I think Jen and I would both, you know, say something about that in our own experience in some of the patients we worked with too. And I love that you're sharing this, because sometimes I was the person sitting there like breathing in a room with a patient, letting them talk about all their traumas and stuff. And then they walk out of that room saying, man, I've never had a session that awesome. I feel great walking out. And I'm like, all we did was sit there and talk and breathe. And my classmates are telling me that I'm crazy. I'm like, no, I just was able to touch this person's pain in a way that they haven't experienced in 20 years just because I sat and listened to them. And it's so hard as a student coming out of this very biomechanically driven or, you know, anatomy driven world to understand, like, maybe I just need to listen to them and give them a little bit of space. And I'm not sure what you think about how we can start to encourage more people to have that understanding.
Well, here's the problem is people who place all of their practice, who are strictly evidence-based, meaning they are blindly evidence-based, are really missing out on the whole point of research. The whole point of research is it's a cycle, everybody. You have to be curious about something and then you test it and then you figure out whether or not your hypothesis was supported and then you ask more questions. So it's not a linear thing. It's cyclical. So we're continually, as scientists, the whole point is to continually be curious and to continue to ask questions. But somewhere along the way, people's egos got in the way and said, like, oh, well, if it's not peer reviewed, and it's not published, then I'm not going to bring it into my practice. And there has to be both. There has to be your curiosity. If you're truly evidence-based, if you truly understand the scientific method, you are continually doing research every time you put your hands on a patient, every time you create a program for a client. And that being said, I do value evidence. I am a literal researcher. So it's obvious that it's very important for us to make sure that we test our hypotheses before doing things that are potentially dangerous or completely ineffective on our patients. But there is something to be said for case studies and anecdotal evidence, which is what walks into your clinic every single day. And going forward, I believe that, I'm very excited to take this what you and I, and I remember that you telling me that story, Dom, of like, you're like, all we did was breathe. And everyone looked at me like I was a crazy. That is my whole life. And so for me, I'm just like, bring it on. Like, I already know what's true and no one can tell me what my truth is. And that's beautiful. But going forward, I'm really excited to bridge the gap and to bring evidence to this thing that we know. So if we can measure outcomes, performance, healing time, right, return to play, and test these hypotheses that you and I know about, like, hey, if we can actually incorporate the humanity back into our rehab, then I think that's what it's going to take for our more evidence-based colleagues to really buy in to what we already know and feel to be very easy and intuitive.
Mm-hmm. And I think like what you said about the ego of it, right? Because as clinicians, it's really easy to say, well, I got this medical degree. I got this, you know, I've done this much schooling, paid this much, taken these tests, and this is what I know to be true. And what I think is so beautiful, you know, in relaying kind of like your experience with your client, whether you were a clinician or not, like I've been to a women's retreat where women were just moving, not being led from a clinician, not being led from a medical provider, but someone who is a somatic therapist. So really looking more from the body in terms of what's happening inside, but all she didn't talk. She just allowed us to move. And we moved like the entire time and then would kind of come into circles and people would go up and share about it. And she would just watch someone move. Okay, where do you feel tightness? Where do you feel restriction? What are your hips telling you? Have you had trauma there before? Has there been something that's been sexually happened in your hips? Mm-hmm. Have you felt a restriction? And her just asking questions and allowing people to move made huge, massive changes that, and people were even at the end, I remember a woman saying, you know, I've had frozen shoulder and I've been going to therapy for 12 weeks and I just got the best range of motion I've had since this weekend, more than I've had going to therapy. And that's where it's like, we get to play in both worlds and we get to bring this to people to actually facilitate healing and drop our own ego about us being the clinician and us being the professional and be able to learn not only from other professions and that other world of things, right? But also the people that come into our clinics, just like you did. You allowed someone else's journey and their own experience to guide your session. That wasn't just you, right? You allowed the person.
I think what I see when I talk to practitioners who, and I know this because I was there, I was afraid of the unknown. I was afraid of not knowing. I actually had to do a lot of work on myself and my own inner world and my own inner dialogue whenever I was questioned. So that's all ego. And I've done so much work there. So it's easy for me to recognize when I see that in other people, when I hear stories of my clients who have been to other practitioners who have gone through this same thing where it's like, if I don't know, then I'm unworthy because I've tied up my worthiness in my accolades. If I've tied up my worthiness in my laurels, I've tied up my worthiness in my degrees and all the things that I've done, rather than who I am as an open-hearted listening human being interacting with another human being. And so if you feel a little ping of like, ooh, like I'm really uncomfortable and your palms start to sweat and you get a little like defensive whenever someone questions something, or whether it's a client or a colleague, ask yourself, am I placing so much pressure on myself? Am I placing so much of my worthiness on my degrees and my profession? Is that because if you feel attacked, it's because you've now combined your worthiness with your degree, with who you are and how you show up professionally in the world, rather than dropping all of that and just listening to the person in front.
You know, one of the topics that we're kind of, you know, touching on a little bit as we go through all of this is trauma, and, you know, traumas that people have experienced in life. And I think it's really important to bring this up because a lot of people want to compare traumas, or when they're trying to view their own trauma, they look outside and they see it's nothing compared to all these traumas that all these other people are going through. Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think some people give themselves enough credit and compassion for the things that they may have gone through in life, again, because they may try to compare it to something someone else is going through, but it doesn't discount the fact that that can be really real for that person. So can you talk a little bit about just trauma in general and what that might mean for someone?
Trauma is something that has happened that has put you in a state of, let's call it panic. And what I see when it comes, and disclaimer, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a trauma specialist. It's just something that I'm curious about and that I've seen happening in the body. I've done some somatic trainings and somatic research. So full disclosure, I'm not a trauma expert. However, as a fellow human, I'm going to speak to what happens in the nervous system. So anytime you have an inciting incident where your body needs to go into fight or flight mode or freeze mode and to protect yourself, there's a nervous system response that's stimulated by your brain. And when we're put into this fight, flight, freeze mode, sometimes what can happen is there's an associated psychological memory response that is integrated into the physical body. And so people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, what happens is when they're triggered, when there's a triggering event or something that has reminded them of that trauma, their body thinks it's actually happening in real time. Now, I like that you said we can't compare traumas. That is so very true. The body is going to react equally to a war time zone as it would to feeling unsafe in a familial situation, in a relationship situation, feeling unsafe walking up on stage and being ridiculed by your peers, right? Anything that makes you feel unsafe is going to incite that fight, flight, freeze response. And so we need to just acknowledge that, because even though we might have a patient, a client coming into us who wasn't a war veteran, it doesn't mean that they've fought their own battles, that they've had to feel unsafe in their own family dynamics or at work or in their own, you know, we have no idea. And we live in a world that we literally were afraid of the air during this pandemic. We were afraid of each other. So we all went through a semi or extreme traumatic experience. And so respecting that and understanding what it actually does to the nervous system, once you're in that panic response, once your body has kind of, you have two buttons when it comes to your nervous system. You have the on button, which is panic, and then you have the off button, which is sleep, rest, and digest. And sometimes that on button can get stuck on. And so in addition to unsticking the on button, we have to teach the body how to push the off button or push that parasympathetic response. And so that's where that's why, Dom, when you said you took your client through breathing, you were unsticking their on button and you were trying to push the off button. You were trying to create a parasympathetic, a down-regulated nervous system in their body in order for them to ever again be able to see results or whatever you were working on with that person. That was the primary thing that needed to happen. Going to the gym and dealing with body movement issues and pain, that can all bring up a lot of stuff. People are very complicated and have super unique histories. So if we're not addressing the emotional component of movements, there are certain movements that I've done with people, oh, it breaks my heart. There are certain movements that I've done with people that put them in a vulnerable position that might feel like a position they were in when they were molested, mm-hmm. when they went through a trauma. It might put them in literal the same body position. There are a number of studies that have said the position that our bodies are in, the movements that our bodies do, not only when we observe someone in a movement that looks powerful or looks sad or looks angry, not only do our mirror neurons allow us to then feel that same emotion that that person, whether regardless of whether they're actually feeling the emotion, they're just doing the movement. Our mirror neurons allow us to feel that emotion. But also when we do that movement, it creates an emotional response in the body. So for example, if I put my head down and I evoke a position that might to you look like sadness, not only do you start feeling more sad and are able to recognize that this is sadness, but my body starts releasing hormones and releasing things that allow my, that create a feeling of sadness in my body. There was one study that the posture study that where you made yourself really big. Well, there was a follow-up study that didn't find, wasn't able to replicate the results, but there have been a number of studies since then, including this really epic study in 2019 that has said, actually, yes, we are able to create movements in our body that evoke emotion, and people are able to understand what emotion we're going through when they see those movements. All being said, they are connected. So long story short, your emotional body and your movements are connected. And I'm very passionate about the next, you know, my next chapter of life, where I'm going to be doing research that really puts that into a rehab and strength perspective, not just all of this research is cased in psychological journals. And I'm really excited to put them in Journal of Sports Medicine, a Journal of Athletic Training, to really change the way and to pave the way for the whole person rehabilitation and care.
It's going to be so huge. For people who are now curious, like, okay, well, how do I know if my pain is really coming from a past trauma, or if I need to emote something to feel something different? Like, where can you say that someone could start with this in home?
So there's Dr. Sarno, and the Sarno Clinic has done a lot of research and has a whole method for this, for back pain specifically. Basically, you journal and you feel whatever anger, whatever emotions are coming up, you journal, and then you notice, how does my back pain feel now? So that's one place to start, is by just bringing awareness to what emotions are real in your body right now. And I know it can be really tough, because we sometimes will live completely blinded by our reactions and our emotions. But meditation is a really good practice to start cultivating an awareness of your body's reactions and your emotional reactions. So I'm a huge fan of meditation. My favorite method is Emily Fletcher's Ziva meditation, Ziva. Excellent. It's mantra-based meditation, a great, easy place to start. Super not intimidating. And Emily's a good friend of mine. She's incredible. Incredible. And then, how do you know if your pain has an emotional component? It likely does. It likely does. If not the cause of your pain, then your pain is probably causing some emotion. So just being really gentle with yourself and understanding that it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both. I also teach a class called The Release. I created this methodology using self-massage and allowing yourself an opportunity to feel into your body. I basically use yoga tune-up balls. My friend Jill created these incredible self-massage balls where you are able to massage into your body and find pain points, finding tight muscles, and then giving yourself space to just feel what comes up and emote what comes up. So yeah, so that's been one really cool way to observe people, many people at a time, and how their emotions are living in their bodies.
It's such cool options there for people to start exploring. I mean, The Release, Jen and I have both sat in on one or two of those classes, and just such a cool combination of, like you said, the tissue and body work with the breath and exploration and music. It's just such a cool and unique way to help people start to explore these things that, like you said, they may have been blinded to. It just gives them a new avenue to maybe find a way down that path. And yeah, appreciate you so much coming on and sharing all this. We're so excited to see what you do into the future and to be able to have you come back and share all the goodies that you find.
I know, the new research by Liz Letchford.
Yes, doctor.
Doctor Liz Letchford, sorry.
No worries, docs. It's been an honor to be here. This is one of my favorite podcasts to listen to when I'm driving to a client's house or on a big trip. I love the nuggets of wisdom that you draw, and I love your perspective, your open-mindedness, and the fact that I'm a little biased, but the fact that you treat the whole person, and you're really making a big difference in people's lives and my own life as a clinician and as a human. So thank you both. Thank you for your perspective. Thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for your love. You're the best, and this was an honor. So thank you.
Oh my goodness, Liz. We're supposed to be showering you with
all the gratitude
because you truly are doing... You're not only doing the work in person with people, but you're now saying, okay, how can I get this work to be accessible to all people in a way that they can understand, that other clinicians will use and understand and be able to help just the masses? And I know that you're going to do that. And we're so excited to see your journey in that and support you through it. And you guys need to go check out all things Liz Letchford, because, you know, she puts out incredible work on social media, really teaching you about the body. I remember that I loved your stories when you were talking about your own neck pain and what you were doing for yourself. And like, she's very educational, but also, you know, take her classes, do the release, start to find this in your body. And I think just that starting point that you're providing people access into is quite amazing. So of course we'll link that all up. You guys go check her out, follow her, love her up, because she's incredible. And Liz, I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future.
Thank you both, and thank you everyone listening. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out.
I just love any podcast that we talk about the connection between mind and body. Jen and I talk about it all the time. And Liz just gave another amazing example of all the ways that our body can be connected with the way that we are doing emotionally, mentally, spiritually, socially. Liz, I know that she's going to continue to do incredible work on that into the future so that we can continue to understand how trauma affects the way that we move and the way that our biomechanics work. If you really enjoyed that podcast, please share it out. Please go rate, leave us a review. Another way to support us, of course, is to order Vivo Barefoot shoes. If you want to use Optimal 15, you can get 15% off on your pair of shoes. They are flat, they are thin, they are flexible. They are going to help those feet breathe and move and learn how to support your body and move more naturally as you do it. So check those out. And of course, we have more PT Pearls and interviews coming at you in the future.